From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how to fix gerrymandering. Some advice to the independent commission that will redraw our legislative and congressional districts.
Sometimes there'll be straight lines and nice lines, and sometimes they'll be a little bit less straight. It's going to depend on what the best way is to represent all the different people of Michigan.
Using old photos to resurrect the long-gone Detroit neighborhood of Black Bottom.
These pictures and pictures that were taken of them in front of their buildings and in front of their homes, what many of them did not know is that these pictures are being taken to destroy where these people are.
What's behind MSU's refusal to turn over thousands of documents to investigators? Perhaps it has to do with insurance liability.
Nobody wants to pay all this money, and it becomes a real fight to the death here.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A federal trial continues this week in Detroit to decide whether the GOP gerrymandered districts in Michigan in 2011. The suit was brought by the Michigan League of Women Voters and could end up affecting the 2020 election. But moving past that, there's a fresh start. An independent commission will draw the legislative and congressional districts for the 2022 election. That commission is now getting some expert guidance in the form of a report from the Princeton Gerrymandering Project. It was prepared by graduate students at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. The founder of the project is here with us now. Sam Wang is a neuroscientist and a professor of molecular biology. Sam, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thanks for having me on today.
Well, people here in Michigan might think, well, voters approved the change to our state constitution. You know, we took away the legislature's right to draw our district boundaries. We gave that power to citizens in the form of a new independent citizens redistricting commission. So we're all good. But you say this is only the beginning of a process. How so?
Oh, that is very definitely the case. It's, of course, exciting that the initiative passed with, I believe, 61% of the vote. And it is true that it was a huge step forward for Michiganders. But of course, as you say, the work now is to establish the commission. So this is a commission that's going to be of 13 citizens of Michigan, and that commission has to form. It basically needs to form a new government agency funded by the government and by taxpayers, but at the same time independent. And they have to set up a staff. They have to run public hearings. People in Michigan have to sign up to join the commission. It's basically starting from scratch, and it's an exciting time, but there is much work for people in the state to do.
And this is a very long, deep, in-depth report, which, by the way, to quote the report, with great opportunity will come great challenges. What do you see as the big pitfalls, big challenges ahead for this commission? How could things go wrong?
Well, let's see. So the Woodrow Wilson School students and I did a deep dive into this, and we looked into the law establishing the commission. And we talked to a lot of stakeholders in Michigan and also in California, where they have a commission already. It seems that in the establishment of an independent commission, there are some key steps that are very important. It's important for these commissioners first to come in with an open mind and open hearts and establish guidelines for being bipartisan or nonpartisan, hiring bipartisan or nonpartisan staff. So that's going to be super important. And that's going to be the very first step in them establishing an open process that takes public input into account.
That's hiring staff, that is choosing commissioners, people volunteering. And to that point, how critical is it in your view to have commissioners who are not affiliated with any party?
Well, the commission has an interesting structure. It's got this requirement that it's got, I believe, 13 members, four Republicans, four Democrats, and five who are independent or declined to state their partisanship. And one interesting feature of this commission is that in order to pass any kind of plan, members of each of those three groups has to agree. So that means that there have to be Democratic votes, Republican votes, and non-affiliated votes to pass anything. I think it's impossible for partisanship to never be part of a process. Of course, people care about politics because they belong to a party. But a key feature of this commission is that Ds, Rs, and independents all have to agree to a plan. So I think that it's more important for people to deal in good faith. It's important for people to speak up for the values that are important to them. But it's also important for everyone to realize that everybody else at the table has to have some potential of buying into a plan. And so this unique, let's call it a supermajority requirement, is going to be very important to keep in mind for the commissioners. And I should say, by the way, that anybody in Michigan who's a voter can register to join the commission. And so I think anyone from Michigan who's interested in politics and interested in good government who's listening to this should think about signing up to join the commission.
And as I look through this report that the great grad students have put together from the Princeton Gerrymandering Project, I notice, for example, things about communities of interest. That's drilled down on. Just what does that mean as Michigan's commission redraws boundaries?
So in the report, which people can read about at gerrymander.princeton.edu/Michigan, I thought I'd throw that in there.
Good deal.
In that report, there are some priorities that have been set in the law that voters approved. One priority is that communities of interest should be represented. And that can mean ethnic communities, it can mean socioeconomic groups, anybody who's got shared interests, whether they are, say, a farm community or a particular ethnic and social group in the Detroit area. All these groups ought to be represented and they have a right to be at the table. And so one priority in this constitutional amendment is that communities of interest should be represented. So that's a major priority. The other major priority is that there not be bias against any political party. And so it's important to keep in mind that whatever plan gets approved has to give a level playing field to both Democrats and Republicans. And so these are major principles that are very high up on the priority list listed in this amendment.
Sam Wang is a Princeton University professor who's the founder of the Princeton Gerrymandering Project. This group has issued a report offering advice on improving Michigan's redistricting process. And as you know, there are now 8 states with these citizen redistricting commissions. Michigan and Colorado joined the club after ballot petitions were passed last November. What lessons can Michigan take from states like California, states like Arizona, which have had these commissions up and running for a few election cycles?
Well, those states, of course, led the way. Arizona was very early along. They had a voting rule that involved, I believe, 5 commissioners with 1 independent commissioner, and that person got a lot of attention, quite a lot of attention. California diffused that a little bit by having more than 1 independent commissioner. And that was one way in which Michigan ended up doing something similar to California by establishing multiple independent commissioners. That's good because it's a process that no longer depends on any one person. So that was an important lesson from California. Another important lesson from California was finding ways to manage public input. So they had a series of public hearings around the state in California where people offered their input. We think examining the process in Michigan, the law says that there shall be public hearings. That's going to provide many opportunities for citizens to weigh in. We think there need to be data-based tools for visualizing communities of interest. Citizens should be able to weigh in and say what their communities are, maybe contribute maps through some kind of online portal. We think that database tools for visualizing those communities of interest and where people live is going to be important not only for the commissioners, but to help the public weigh in and say what matters to them.
Because being fair and being transparent is important for the public to be able to buy into this.
Yes. I mean, if things go well, there will be hundreds or even thousands of public comments. And if you think about managing that, that's a lot of public comment. And so, for instance, one might want to make sure that one understood about the Arab American community in Dearborn and Dearborn Heights. That could be important. Or maybe farmers in the Upper Peninsula or in the northern part of Michigan. Maybe that would be an important community to lay out on a map. And so there's a lot of management of traffic where the commissioners have to take all that input in. They also have to get to know one another and form connections of trust across the partisan aisle. And managing all this is a pretty large exercise in human relations. I mean, redistricting is technical, but ultimately the way this commission works, it's people doing the work. And I will say one thing that emerged in our interviews of people in California was that it was really striking that commissioners in California made friends with one another. Democrats and Republicans ate together. They traveled together. California is a pretty big state. So they got to know each other pretty well on those long road trips. And that was something that seemed to be very important for their success, was being willing to form those personal connections.
And the way you kind of described all of this certainly gives us a sense of what's notable about the political geography of Michigan, doesn't it? The way that this commission needs to address that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a balance because often people think of drawing fair districts as just drawing compact shapes that are nice looking on a map that aren't too complicated. But honestly, if you look at the diversity of Michigan and all the kinds of things that are happening, drawing a compact map might not be that hard in northern Michigan. You could imagine doing it because it's not too densely populated there. But once you get into the Detroit area or Lansing or Grand Rapids, you start seeing communities that deserve representation, that need to find some way of being represented, not only in Congress, but also in the state legislature. And so then the question arises, how to take care of these communities? And what that means is that one has to be thoughtful about drawing those lines. Sometimes they'll be straight lines and nice lines, and sometimes they'll be a little bit less straight. It's going to depend on what the best way is to represent all the different people of Michigan.
You were saying to me, Michigan is ground zero in gerrymandering. Why is that? Why do you say that?
Well, back in 2010, there was a wave election. So most recently, a few months ago, we saw a wave election that favored Democrats. In 2010, there was a wave election that favored Republicans. And Republicans gained single party control over the line drawing process in about half a dozen states. And Michigan was one of them. And they were aggressive about asserting themselves. The law at the time allowed them to draw districts that favored themselves. One of the most partisan maps in America is the Michigan congressional map. Also, the legislative map has a strong tilt to it. And so because of that, that single party control over districting, Michigan's map is a bit out of whack right now. And so the next cycle, which will begin in 2021 of drawing maps, that next map drawing cycle is an opportunity to start over again and to try to draw a map that does a good job of representing everyone and not just the party that happened to gain control in a particular year.
And you are coming to Michigan to kind of meet with the voters, not politicians crowd who pushed this proposal successfully over the finish line. Will you also be consulting and meeting with future commissioners as they come on board?
Well, we don't know who the commissioners are yet. And so that's an open process of application. And so I'd love to meet those commissioners someday. There's going to be an onboarding process that some person's going to run. But we're going to be presenting our findings to voters, not politicians, tell them what we found out. Our report is publicly available. Anybody can download it. And we hope that if people are interested in becoming a commissioner, they will read our report and read what we found out when we did a deep dive into how commissions get formed and the ways in which they can do their job.
Sam Wang is a Princeton University professor who's the founder of the Princeton Gerrymandering Project. The group has issued a report offering advice on improving the redistricting process in Michigan. Sam, thank you for sharing your work with us and for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it is almost Valentine's Day. The candy aisles at the grocery store are filled with pink and red goodies, and the jewelry commercials, they're running nonstop. With all this love in the air, we want to hear from you. What do you think is the most romantic spot in Michigan, and why? Let us know, and you might hear your answer on air. You can leave us a voicemail by calling 734-764-7840. Let me give you that again, 734-764-7840. Give us your name, where you live, and your pick for most romantic spot. Or leave your response in the box at the top of the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What do we lose when an urban area is, air quotes here, renewed? An exhibition on display at the Detroit Public Library's main branch through March 15th asks that very question. It's called Black Bottom Street View. University of Detroit Mercy architecture professor Emily Cutill used a treasure trove of old photographs to recreate the long-gone Detroit neighborhood known as Black Bottom. It was the center of Detroit's black community until it was torn down in the 1950s to make way for the I-75 expressway and other development. Cutill's display groups the photos by street, by address, so you walk through the exhibit as if you were walking through these long-gone streets. The exhibit is on display at the main branch of the Detroit Public Library in the Adams Strom Hall, and that's where I recently met up with Detroit historian Jamon Jordan for a walking tour of the recreated Black Bottom. When I stop and think, this is actually kind of like a Google Street View.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. And what it does is there are many people who have heard about Black Bottom. They know the story, but they could never envision. So they create their own visions of what it is. And basically those visions are based on what people have told them. Now you can kind of get a view of what Black Bottom looked like just before it was destroyed, because these pictures, of course, were taken just before the destruction of Black Bottom began. In fact, that's why these pictures were taken. These pictures were taken so that they could plot the areas that are going to be first demolished in the urban renewal program that follows the National Housing Act of 1949, when the federal government is funding cities to remove old structures.
When I look at this, it strikes me how beautifully overlaid these photos are. So as you walk along, you really do feel like you're on the street. I feel like we're right here on Macomb Street, mm-hmm. walking by homes. I see these cars from the late 1940s.
That's right.
And I see people.
That's right.
What do you think they're saying to us?
One of the things that they're saying to us is, see me. You know, I want you to see me. What many of them did not know is that these pictures and pictures that were taken of them in front of their buildings and in front of their homes, what many of them did not know is that these pictures are being taken to destroy where these people are. They were unaware of that. Most of the people in Black Bottom at that time are renters. And even the owners got a notice of when they're going to be removing and taking the land by eminent domain and destroying the structures. But the renters got even a later notice. So most of the people that you see photographed here have no knowledge of what's going to happen. So they see people taking pictures and they want to be seen. They're showing themselves. They say, see me, take a picture of me. But they have no clue that these pictures are being taken to demolish the places that they're standing on.
Tell us about one or two buildings that really, in your view, were the heart of Black Bottom, of the heart of this neighborhood.
Yeah, so we're going to go down to we're on Rivard Street. We're going to go to Rivard Street.
Okay, and we are walking through these wooden frames that map the streets, and then wrapped around them are the photographs that take you house by house, building by building. So we've walked along Rivard, and where are we now?
So we're on Rivard and Congress. On Rivard and Congress. And when you come over to the other side, you're on Rivard and Larned, which is the end. On Larned and Rivard, we would be right next to the home of Fannie Richards. All right? So her home would have been about right here. So Fannie Richards is the first African-American public school teacher in the city of Detroit. Her family moved to the city of Detroit in 1850, and she lives right here in Black Bottom till 1922 when she passes away. And she's not only an African-American public school teacher, when she comes to the city of Detroit, Detroit has no public schools for African-Americans. So she's teaching at a private school inside of Second Baptist Church, the oldest African-American church in the state of Michigan. In 1865, after the Civil War, Detroit Public Schools finally says, we're going to allow African-Americans to have a school, and it's called Colored School. So it's Jim Crow. It's a segregated form of education. And she gets a job at Colored School Number 2, and realizes that the schools are unequal. And she leads a lawsuit to overturn segregation in Detroit public schools in 1868. In 1869, the Michigan Supreme Court rules that segregation in Detroit public schools is unconstitutional. She teaches for 50 years in the city of Detroit. And she teaches in an integrated neighborhood, which is another part of Black Bottom that we need to understand, is that it's an area where African Americans are there, but it's also an area where immigrants, German immigrants, about a third of those German immigrants are also Jewish, Russian immigrants, Polish immigrants, Irish immigrants, Italians. Of course, Greektown is in the Lower East Side right next to Black Bottom because it's an immigrant site. And so these immigrants are living alongside African Americans. And for a while, the area is integrated with African Americans, many of whom have been there since the 1800s, like Fannie Richards, and immigrants who have been coming in waves, in successive waves, the Germans being one of the earliest groups, but then all the way to the Italians and Greeks in the early 1900s.
What was a building that, as we can point to it, you can say, tell us something about who was there and what it meant to the community?
Yeah, so let's go over around the corner here.
Right. So we're going around the corner, and what are we on?
So we're at Barstow. So Barstow was one of the principal elementary schools in Black Bottom. So we had Barstow, we had Duffield, and of course, when Miller was founded, it was founded as a middle school. It opened in 1919 as Dubois Intermediate School. Because of segregation, you had a group of parents who are going to push for segregation in the schools, even in Black Bottom. So you have African Americans living there with a lot of other groups, but they're going to fight for segregation in the schools in Black Bottom. They're not going to fight for segregation in Barstow. So Barstow is going to stay integrated throughout its entire tenure before it's destroyed, of course, in the destruction of Black Bottom. So does Duffield. Duffield stays integrated. But Miller, which was the middle school, is going to turn into a high school. Because what the parents are really focusing on, the white parents are focusing on segregation, is in the high school. The major high school that serves that community is Eastern High School. And they turn Miller into a high school where most of the African-American students are going to be zoned to between 1933 and 1957. So the middle school becomes a high school, and the high school becomes a predominantly almost all, but not totally all, white high school. And, of course, now Eastern High School is Martin Luther King Jr. High School, named after the civil rights leader who fought to end segregation. It's just the irony of Detroit's history.
So as I look at these homes and I just think about how many generations of families, and as you talk about, a teacher who came here in the 1800s, so this was not new. There were generations who called this home.
That's right. Not only were there generations, which is highly important, that people came in successive waves, that early group of African Americans are here in the 1800s during the period of slavery and the Underground Railroad, and of course, Black Bottom is going to play a central role in the Underground Railroad story of the city of Detroit. And then, of course, the Great Migration in the early 1900s. You have African Americans coming from the South. Thousands of African Americans are coming from the South to places like Detroit, but also Chicago, Philadelphia, Boston, and, of course, Harlem, New York. So you have these successive waves. But not only do you have that, you have cooperations of families. So these houses that we're looking at, in almost every case, there's not one family living in them. There's three and four families. Largely because of housing discrimination, they don't have other options. So a house that might have originally been built for one family is going to have two and three families. And sometimes they're going to make additions to the house so that it can house more people. Never, ever really able to fully house all the people that are there. But to better accommodate groups of families who don't have other options, these homes are going to not have just one successive family living there from generation to generation, but sometimes three and four families living there for successive generations.
So as we walk along here and we see these homes where families lived,
yes,
and businesses, and then when did this go away and how quickly?
So in 1944, the mayor of the city of Detroit, Edward Jeffries, has proposed a plan along with the city council to begin demolishing old structures. Gratiot Redevelopment Plan. It went through a success of names, but that was one of the major names it was known by, the Gratiot Redevelopment Plan. It's really a form of urban renewal, which for many African Americans, they call Negro removal. And because many times they would be the first groups of people whose homes and businesses would be taken by this. The city didn't really have the funds to do it. So even when the city council passes a Gratiot Redevelopment Plan in 1946, the Jeffries City Plan, they can't fund the destruction of Black Bottom. But that's going to change. It's going to change when the federal government passes the National Housing Act of 1949, where they're going to give states and cities money to destroy old structures. It went through a number of names. Slum clearance was one of the names. Of course, urban renewal kind of stuck. And of course, again, African Americans called it Negro removal.
This is semantics. We're talking semantics.
That's right. And so what we get is, after the passage of the National Housing Act in summer of 1949, within 2 months, they begin tearing down the first buildings in Black Bottom. So it only takes, once the federal government passes the law or passes the ordinance and going to begin funding this destruction, 2 months later, the city of Detroit has begun demolishing the first buildings. And they're going to be demolishing them throughout the 50s, to the mid-50s.
And then comes President Eisenhower,
right,
and the push for freeways,
that's
expressways.
Right. So we get the National Highway Act in 1956. By the time we get to 1956, most of Black Bottom is already gone. Not all of it, but most of it is already gone. And so now they're going to build a freeway through the main street that ran through Black Bottom, and it's also going to run through Paradise Valley. So now Paradise Valley is going to be part of this urban renewal, and the land is going to be taken in Paradise Valley, which was the Black business district, which had over 350 Black-owned businesses by the 1930s. It's going to be wiped out as well. And so we can go down to Hastings Street, which is the major casualty of Black Bottom in Paradise Valley. And so Hastings, on the western border of Black Bottom, in this exhibit is Hastings Street. So all of the structures you see here, of course, are gone. In fact, all of the structures that we see, period, are gone. This is not all of Black Bottom. This Black Bottom street view is not all of Black Bottom. This is the first section of Black Bottom to be destroyed.
Yes.
You can see there
how big it was.
How big Black Bottom was. And then this is, that square is the first section that was chosen in 1949 to be the original place to be destroyed. And so these structures would be first to be destroyed, but they would not be the only ones. We still have some of the schools. Of course, we have the, which is now the DeQuinder Cut, but that would have been the Grand Trunk Railroad, where the DeQuinder Cut is. So we still have some places that we can actually plot ourselves. And of course, we have many of the churches. The churches tell the story of Black Bottom probably better than anything that I can think of. Because we have African-American churches like Second Baptist, which is in Greektown. It's been there since 1857 on one block, on one corner of Monroe.
And anyone who's been to Greektown for a night out has walked by this church.
That's right. And then on the other end of the block, you got St. Mary's, which is the German Catholic Church, the first German Catholic Church in the state. If you walk around the corner from there on Lafayette, and would have been Hastings, but it's now Lafayette in the Chrysler Service Drive, you have the Annunciation Greek Orthodox Church. You saunter down towards Congress Street, and you're going to pass Church of Our Holy Family, the Italian Catholic Church. If you're up on Gratiot, you're going to see St. Joseph's Catholic Church, another German Catholic Church, and St. John's Lutheran Church. And across the street is Trinity, historic Trinity Lutheran Church. The history of these immigrant communities, Germans, Jewish people, African-Americans, Italians and Irish, the history of all of these different groups who are coming to the city of Detroit and living in this small space, their history is still encapsulated in those churches that still exist, some of them from the 1800s. Yeah. The structures are still there.
Redlining was in full swing when people were driven out of these homes.
Right.
Eminent domain, the houses are gone. Where did they go?
So if you were had some level of economic resources, you had more options. Some African Americans who had the economic ability to buy their way out of housing segregation. They paid more for homes, and they were able to move into places. You have some of your first African-American families moving into Boston Edison in the 1940s. And part of it is because of what's happened to Black Bottom and Paradise Valley. They're ending up in using their wealth to buy their way into places that would never have let them come in before. But for working-class people and for poor people, they have less options. And what they're going to end up being, a large percentage of them, the overwhelming percentage of them, are going to end up in the area where Jewish people are leaving after World War II, which is the 12th Street, Dexter, Linwood, and Grand River area of the west side of the city of Detroit.
And where you're describing was the epicenter of the uprising of 1967. How was that connected to what happened here in Black Bottom?
Yes, it's very connected, because what we can't see is the fact that some of the people who end up on Dexter, Linwood, 12th Street, the area which, of course, is ground zero for the 1967 rebellion, some of those people had just moved into that area just less than a decade before the uprising. They remember being kicked out of their home. They remember losing their business. So that's a part of what's happening. I mean, it plays on many levels. Joel's record shop, which was at 3530 Hastings Street, is forced to move because of the building of the freeway. They end up on 12th. And, of course, they're going to be one of the businesses that's going to get looted and destroyed. It's going to help to bring down the life of a great musicologist in the city of Detroit, Jovan Battle, who's been recording the sermons of Reverend Clarence LaVaughn Franklin. And, of course, the children of Reverend Clarence LaVaughn Franklin, who sing in the choir at New Bethel Baptist Church, one of whom is a great singer named Aretha Franklin. And so all of this history is a part of Hastings Street history and a part of Black Bottom's history, but it becomes the history of the city of Detroit. There's almost no area in the city of Detroit that's not somehow connected to this history in Black Bottom, because you have the Jewish history there, you have German history there, you have Italian history there, of course, African-American history there. All of that history is encapsulated in this Lower East Side neighborhood, and that's going to go on to create all kinds of other places. At St. Antoine and Congress, which the exhibit doesn't go that far, but if it went one more block over to St. Antoine and Congress, that was the home of Isaac and Sarah Cousins. They were on the corner of St. Antoine and Congress. Isaac and Sarah Cousins came to the city of Detroit in the early 1830s, and by 1850, they've opened their home to being the first Jewish synagogue in the state of Michigan, Bethel. So Temple Bethel is right there in the same neighborhood as where African Americans are leading Underground Railroad abolitionist movements. So all of that is part of the same history. And it's connected to every other history, because Bethel now, of course, is in Bloomfield. It's in Bloomfield Hills. And so all of that history is connected.
Finally, Jamont, as visitors come to see this exhibit and walk through, what do you want them to think about as they're walking up and down these streets and looking at these photos? What thought do you hope will be in their mind?
The big thought is that there is no area in the city of Detroit, and I argue in the state of Michigan, that acre for acre has this much significant history that transforms Michigan's history. That's the big view. But the smaller view is, when you look at the homes, now you get a understanding of families. These were people. people who had jobs, had thoughts, had aspirations to do something great. Many of them had left Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana, the Jim Crow South, to make a way for themselves in the city of Detroit. And they're going to. They're going to make a way for themselves, and they're going to transform Detroit. They're going to work at Ford Motor Company when he's offering $5 a day for all workers. They're going to work at what is going to become GM. They're going to work at what is called Chrysler and many other factories. And they're going to transform the city of Detroit from a burgeoning town to a major economic center in America. And their history is Black Bottom, too.
Jermaine Jordan, we want to thank you for sharing Black Bottom's history with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Historian Jermaine Jordan gives walking history tours of Detroit through his business Black Scroll Network History and Tours. The Black Bottom Street View exhibition will be on display through March 15th. You'll find it on the third floor of the main branch of the Detroit Public Library, right across from the DIA. Coming up after the break, officials at Michigan State University have been promising more transparency. But the university has yet to hand over thousands of documents related to Larry Nassar to outside investigators. We'll find out why after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan State University says it is entering a new era, one with greater transparency and accountability. John Engler is out as interim president. A new healing fund for survivors is in the works. But the school is still refusing to hand over about 6,000 internal documents to special investigators, which is ironic because these are the same investigators the school actually invited to come dig into the Nassar case last year. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells is looking into this. Kate, what is the school saying about why these documents need to stay secret?
Two words, insurance litigation, which are the world's least sexy words. But stay with me on this because it gets interesting, I promise. So basically, you have to go back to this past summer when MSU settles for $500 million with the Larry Nassar survivors.
Michigan State University will pay $500 million to settle claims from survivors of the biggest sex assault case in sports history. 332 women sued Michigan State for allegedly ignoring complaints about disgraced former doctor Larry Nassar.
So $500 million is obviously a lot of money, and everybody's asking, where is MSU going to get this money? And what they do is they turn around and sue their insurance carriers.
Michigan State is suing its insurance carriers to get them to pay claims related to the Larry Nassar scandal.
So in this lawsuit, Michigan State is essentially saying to its insurance carriers, hey, we are waiting for you to pay us. We have bought policies with you that is supposed to cover stuff like this, sexual assault cases. You haven't paid us our money. It's time to pay up.
So MSU actually has insurance for stuff like sexual assaults. Is that normal?
You know, it's actually becoming increasingly common, not only for universities, but for businesses, you know, kind of the post-Me Too movement. But for universities, it actually makes a lot of sense. They looked at the Penn State Jerry Sandusky case, where the university paid out millions of dollars to victims. And this is the kind of thing that now some universities like MSU just carry for instances like this.
But there are some loopholes.
Yeah, there are two loopholes in MSU's sexual assault insurance policies, the fine print. Loophole number one, if a school leader or mandatory reporter knew about Larry Nassar's sexual abuse but did not report it to the, quote, proper authorities, then the insurance carrier is off the hook. They do not have to pay MSU a dime for the Larry Nassar legal cost. Loophole number two, if the school knew about Larry Nassar's sexual molestation, but they didn't tell the insurance carrier right away, essentially give them a heads up of like, hey, guys, we may have an issue coming up here, then same thing. The insurance carrier, once again, does not have to pay MSU.
Which kind of sounds like what happened at Penn State. The school settled with victims and then duked it out with its insurance carriers who also didn't want to pay all the Sandusky-related legal bills.
Exactly. And these fights can get really nasty. We saw in the Penn State case that actually some of the most damning information didn't just come out of like Jerry Sandusky's criminal hearing. It came out of these like total brawls of this insurance litigation. Insurance companies can depose people. They can call them in and have them testify under oath.
you know, nobody wants to pay all this money, and it becomes a real fight to the death here.
So that's where these 6,000 internal documents come in, ones MSU doesn't want to turn over to investigators?
Right. And it's not just that it's any investigators here. The irony, as you mentioned, is that these are the investigators that last year MSU trustees said, please come in and investigate us. This is the only way we're all going to heal as a community and move forward, and we will cooperate fully. But then we saw at the end of that year that the Attorney General's special investigator said that absolutely did not happen, that MSU didn't cooperate in terms of what they were hoping to get. MSU turned over a ton of documents to the special investigator. But the special investigator's office says we'll never be able to know what really happened here, what really happened with Larry Nassar, unless we can see everything.
So you talked to Trustee Dan Kelly.
I did. I talked to him after one of the board meetings last month, and I basically said, look, the AG's office is really mad. Why aren't you guys releasing these?
First of all, when we assert the attorney-client privilege, it's with regard to the opinions of the attorneys. It's not with regard to the factual basis. We turned over the factual documentation. We certainly turned over all of our digital information.
Basically, Kelly is using legalese here to say, hey, these 6,000 documents are, you know, just opinions back and forth between us and our lawyers. This has nothing to do with the actual Nassar case. And so then I asked him, you know, if there's no smoking gun here, then why not just go ahead and release them?
Well, when we're in litigation with an insurance company, I don't believe it is the insurance company is entitled to the legal opinions of our attorneys. I don't believe they are.
And here we are. We're back full circle at the insurance lawsuit.
Which MSU could lose if the insurers find out they covered up Larry Nassar's abuse?
Which is what's so frustrating here is that, you know, you can understand where Kelly is coming from, where he's saying we don't want to give the insurance folks all of this information here from our attorneys. But on the other hand, the thing that could make them potentially lose the lawsuit is really a smoking gun if they are covering something up here. I also talked about that to one of the new trustees, Kelly Tebe. She was just elected. And she says, yeah, you know, MSU needs some real transparency.
There is a group of people that are ready to be like, we're done with this. There's no reason to hide. And, you know, if it's going to make us look bad, you know, we will grow from this, though. And we'll learn from this and we can move forward.
But on the other hand, let's just say these documents aren't actually covering anything up. No smoking gun here. Instead, maybe the documents are just a bunch of legal strategy and they don't want insurers to have a leg up. Or let's say there's evidence that some MSU administrator didn't immediately tell its insurance carriers about Nassar's abuse. Is that worth the school losing $500 million in this lawsuit?
Right. And that is the conundrum that these trustees are essentially facing. Do we be completely transparent and possibly risk losing $500 million? I talked about that to one of the other new trustees, Brianna Scott.
We were to be excluded based on some exclusionary requirements that MSU maybe didn't do or people that they needed to contact at a certain time or little tiny little technicalities like that. If we lose $500 million because of things like that, we have to weigh whether or not that's worth it.
So bottom line, MSU has 6,000 internal documents. It will not give Nassar investigators without them. As you say, we're never going to really know what happened and whether there was a cover-up. But on the other hand, maybe the documents don't have any kind of smoking gun.
And that's something that these trustees are going to have to figure out. We know that one of two things is going to happen. One, either survivors are going to keep up the pressure on trustees and say, you have to release these documents. Let's see if that actually happens. But number two, we know that for a fact, the insurance litigation is going to go forward. And that will be fascinating to watch to see what comes out of that, whether or not the trustees do release these documents.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells. As always, Kate, thank you for breaking this all down for us.
Thanks, Cindy.
We often hear politicians use buzzwords, things like media elite, fake news. Some seem straightforward enough, others not so much. After the recent election cycle, we got this question from a Michigan radio listener.
My name is Ellen Rustin, and I was raised in the Ann Arbor, Chelsea region, and I'm a former business owner. Well, I heard the interview with Senator Shirky, and he was talking about making Michigan more business friendly, and it started me questioning, what does that mean exactly? How do you make Michigan more business friendly? I just would love to know what that means.
So stateside, heard that question. We are looking for answers, reaching out to business owners, business leaders around the state to get their views. And we've lined up a series of conversations drilling down on what business friendly really means in Michigan. But let's begin by trying to figure out just where this phrase came from. And for that, we turn to Ann Curzan, Michigan Radio's linguistics expert and a U of M professor of English linguistics and education. You're smiling as you heard that question about business friendly. And it's really something politicians across the country love to say. When did this buzzword become a thing?
I love the question because my immediate answer is it depends who you ask. And I'm so glad that you're going to be talking to a range of people about what does it mean to make Michigan business friendly, quote unquote, because what that's going to mean is going to vary a lot, I think. Your question, when did it become a buzzword? It looks like the 1990s. But that's not the first time we had a sighting of it. And I was surprised how early the Oxford English Dictionary has a sighting of business friendly in 1948.
Right after World War II. Wow.
And it's
older than me.
It's in the Boston Daily Globe. And the quote is, it's a headline, Dewey to pledge labor business friendly term.
There we go.
But when you look at usage in Google Books and Grand Viewer, where you can look check millions of books, it looks like it's the 1990s when this term takes off and suddenly we're all talking about things being business friendly or people, specifically politicians, being business friendly. When I've looked at this, there is a lot of debate out there about what this term means, and it gets pretty political pretty fast. You won't be surprised to know. And in part, what the word or the compound means, business friendly, depends on, are we talking about a city or a state? Are we talking about a politician? Are we talking about a policy? All of those are going to inflect the word a little bit differently. And then if we start with just the neutral definition, business friendly means favorable to business interests or business concerns.
Okay.
Right.
Pretty straightforward. Yeah.
Where it gets tricky is what is favorable to business interests and business concerns.
That is in the eye of the beholder.
Well, that's exactly right. Some of the cynical folks will say, if we're talking about a politician or a legislator, if you say they're business friendly, what that really means is they will follow corporate lobbyists.
Mm, okay.
They'll say how business friendly a politician is how often they'll say yes to requests from lobbyists.
Okay.
Right. So that's a kind of cynical view of that. For other people, it's about tax rates. So what kinds of tax rates, and do politicians or cities or states have tax rates that would be favorable to businesses? But other people flip it and say business friendly is about, is there an educated workforce? Do you have a good transportation system? How are the regulations? And there again, you see a debate of is lack of regulation business friendly or is good stringent regulation actually business friendly in terms of what makes it possible and profitable to do business.
So
somewhere.
You can take that this compound business friendly, hold it up and look at it every which way. And each time you look at it and from every angle, you get a different take, which strikes me then to ask, how does a term like that serve a politician? What kind of tool is an amorphous phrase like this for a politician?
Well, it can be a great tool because if you say I'm going to support business-friendly policies, well, I now have a lot of wiggle room in here to have people interpret that. However, now I'm a little more troublesome and says, well, what would those policies be? And I have to nail that down. But if what I want to suggest is I'm going to be trying to help Michigan or the country or the city be a place where businesses want to come and where businesses can thrive, people can interpret that in lots of positive ways and say, oh, that's someone who's invested in educating the workforce. That's someone who wants to make sure that there's support for entrepreneurship here. Or someone could say that means that person is going to cut tax rates for businesses, and I agree with that or don't agree with that. or that is someone who is going to be in lobbyist pockets?
Boy, that it suits that the soundbite when you've got the TV cameras and the microphones and everybody's like, and you've got to do that because it sounds like whatever the listener is hearing, they'll project their sense of that on there, for better or for worse, I guess.
Well, and in general, I think if you're thinking about it, the city or state or even the national level, to say business friendly in the best sense is, sure, do we want people, businesses to invest in the city or in the state? That seems like it would be good for the economy, potentially good for all kinds of things. So, yes, and then exactly how is that going to happen? That's where it gets complicated.
Now, business friendly, this hyphen, has cousins, doesn't it?
I loved thinking about that. As I started thinking about business friendly, I thought, what other nouns can you put in that slot, that initial slot? So I went and looked, and there is one that stands out as the most popular, X-friendly. Do you have a gut intuition of what it is?
User-friendly?
Yes.
Is it?
Oh. It's absolutely user-friendly, which comes out of computing. That starts in the 1970s, and it takes off in the late 1970s, and then people are talking about technologies that are user-friendly. And then starting in the early 1990s, we start to see other X-friendly terms take off. Family-friendly.
Right.
Eco-friendly. Kid or child-friendly. Earth-friendly. Business-friendly. Consumer-friendly. Pet-friendly.
And you know what? You completely get what each one means. When you say that you have a child-friendly home, you completely get a sense that breakables are put away and for little ones, there's locks and safety things.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is family friendly. So this is a place to bring your kids.
Yep.
Now, it also made me think about this very funny moment. I vote on the word of the year every year. And in 2004, in the category most unnecessary word of the year, we had carb friendly. And this was a buzzword, you may or may not remember, for foods that were low in carbohydrates. And the argument people made was this is unnecessary because how in the world is this carb-friendly unless it's carb-friendly because what, you aren't eating the carbs and so you're saving their lives because you're not eating them?
I love that.
And it won the category.
It won. Most unnecessary word of the year.
For 2004.
Well, a fascinating look, and I want to thank you for walking us through kind of the linguistic angle of what business-friendly really means. It's always great to talk language with Michigan Radio's linguistics expert, Anne Curzan. Thank you.
Thanks, Cindy.
And next Monday, a conversation about what business-friendly means for small business versus what it means for big corporations. And before we go, hundreds of mourners turned out today at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center in Dearborn, paying their final respects to John Dingell, of course, who died last Thursday at age 92. Here are the voices of some who showed up to say farewell.
He was the epitome of public service. His fingerprints are on every piece of major legislation over the past 50, 60 years, and I wanted to pay my final respects to him and his wife.
Everybody's talking about his humor. He was humorous, but he was very on top of issues. He did his homework. He knew the issues. When you went into a meeting, you couldn't BS him. I don't know if you can play that, but you had to be on top of your game.
He was a huge supporter of the Arab American community, worked with me to change the Lebanese travel ban, one of the most powerful people in the world at that time. And yet he listened and always treated people like human beings.
I had a meeting with John Dingell many years ago before the VA hospital. By the way, I retired from the VA hospital in Detroit. And I had a meeting before the hospital was built. And at this meeting, there were a lot of dissatisfied people that the hospital was going to be built in Detroit. And John Dingell stood up that night and he said, listen, as John Conyers district, he has the right to want the hospital in his area as well as anybody else. I don't have anything else to say about that. And since then, I've been his fan.
And that is our Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.